Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Dean Strang. He's best known these days as one of the two defense attorneys for accused murderer Stephen Avery, a case made internationally famous through the hit Netflix documentary series Making a Murderer. Dean is a criminal defense attorney with the firm Strang Bradley and has taught law at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Last week, we discussed the Stephen Avery case and some of the concerns that it raises about the criminal justice system. This week, we'll turn more specifically to a discussion of criminal representation for the indigent and a book that Dean wrote about an entirely different case titled Worse Than the Devil: Anarchists, Clarence Darrow, and Justice in a Time of Terror. Now, Dean, in some other interviews that you've done, in particular, there's a two-part series that you did with Forbes, you made some interesting observations about the economics of representation and of indigent representation. Let's start with your own economics of the Avery case. Despite the fact that Avery paid you and your fellow defense lawyer, Jerry Buting, $240,000 to defend him, my understanding is you ended up making just a little over minimum wage. That's hard to believe on the face of it. So briefly walk me through how that works.
Sure. Absolutely. $240,000 is the amount of money that was left Mr. Avery to spend on defense counsel in the murder case after, you know, the out-of-pocket expenses of the civil lawyers were taken from the settlement.
In the settlement that he had on a case unrelated to the
civil
murder
lawsuit,
right,
arising from his wrongful conviction. So that $240,000 went to my firm and then was split with Jerry Buting's firm. From that $240,000, which was, you know, as you would say, an all-in number, the lawyers had to get paid, Jerry's firm and mine, and all out-of-pocket expenses had to come. So defense investigation, transcripts, any scientific testing we wanted to do, travel, lodging, witness fees, all of it. And what was left then would be fees for us. So if you, you know, if you split it, if you split the money, you're talking about $120,000 before expenses. If you take expenses out of that, and I don't remember off the top of my head what those were anymore, but probably, I'm guessing now, but probably $40,000-$50,000 total, then what you're left with is something under $100,000 each, okay? Jerry and my firms. We probably conservatively put well over 1,000 hours each of our own time into the case, and then paralegals, other lawyers with time into the case.
Overhead for the firm, I imagine, too.
Well, and I haven't gotten to that.
Oh.
I mean, you know, but you know, you can do the math on breaking this down on an hourly basis. And then I was with a firm of, at that time, 13 lawyers. Jerry was with a firm of three lawyers and support people. So as a partner in these firms, you've got to contribute, obviously, to the overhead of the firm. Payroll for everybody else in the firm, rent, malpractice insurance, you know, computer-assisted legal resource, you know, all the things that go into running the small business of a law firm. So yeah, I can't do the calculation exactly anymore, but by the time you get down, you're working for, I'm sure, something over minimum wage, but not, you know, not greatly over minimum wage. Now, that's a decision you make going in. We knew that, you know, that was the all-in number. We knew that. It was important to get into the case for us because he was the most detested man in Wisconsin, and he came to us. Mm. You know, that's not a case you ought to turn down if you're a defense lawyer. It's not a case you want to turn down if you're a defense lawyer. And, you know, it also – publicity isn't a bad thing for lawyers. You know, there's no secret about that. You don't want to go out seeking it, but if it's coming to you, that's not a bad thing, or potentially not a bad thing if you show well, you know, if you do a good job on the case. And you know, just sort of awareness among other lawyers that you're handling the case, mm-hmm. and then the ability of other lawyers to assess and the public to assess how you're doing with the case potentially down the road will be good for a lawyer's business or reputation.
Now, you also have claimed that the prosecution is always going to outspend the defense. And it doesn't matter even if the defense is someone rich, like you know, O.J. Simpson or Bill Cosby. Again, many listeners I think are going to have a hard time believing that. So explain how that works.
Well, it just is so. I guess part of it would be how you define prosecution. But let's take out the sunk costs of a courthouse and staffing a courthouse and, you know, running the judicial system, which, as I say, is sort of a sunk cost. That's going to be there anyway. But the policing costs and the prosecution costs for a large, you know, prosecution really are going to be substantial if you could capture those. You're always going to run into a public expense when you if you could capture all of the investigative and prosecutorial expenses that I think well exceeds the you know sort of checkbook of almost any criminal defendant you can imagine, even the very rare well heeled you know. Dennis Kozlowski, Martha Stewart, Bill Cosby, you know, those cases, the idea of defendant being attached to the name of a wealthy person after a comma is so rare that we hear about it almost every time it happens. They become items of national news.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Dean Strang, former defense attorney for Stephen Avery, a case profiled in the Netflix series Making a Murderer. But there's an irony to that, what you just said, it seems to me, that on the one hand, in terms of spending and resources, the state has the advantage over the defense. But again, going back to this issue of economics for the defense attorneys, for pay rates for the attorneys involved, it's probably fair to say that a successful defense lawyer is going to make more than the attorneys that are prosecuting the cases and the police officers involved. So maybe that's what the public sees, and that's where that sense of
– Well, you know, define success because some of the very best criminal defense lawyers in America are staff public defenders across the country for public defender agencies.
Okay, let me reframe that then. Highest paid criminal defense lawyers then.
The highest paid criminal defense lawyers absolutely make more money. Certainly in a good year than would any public prosecutor. You know, prosecutors in the end are government employees and the salary ranges are what you expect for government employees. And indeed, they're lower than they should be. District attorneys are chronically underpaid in most places in this country, as are public defenders. So yes, in the private sector, financially successful lawyers will make more than a prosecutor. Criminal defense within the private sector, criminal defense is not a particularly high-paying area of practice. I think corporate law and probably some, you know, very, again, successful from a financial measure plaintiffs, personal injury lawyers probably, you know, are well above what even financially successful criminal defense lawyers make. But, you know, we're not in poverty either.
So let's think about how this works for representation of the indigent. Here in Syracuse, we don't have a public defender system. We have a court-appointed attorney system. So sketch out how the economics of criminal defense works for these attorneys. And again, in Syracuse, my understanding is that a court-appointed attorney is paid $60 an hour for misdemeanors, $75 an hour for felonies, and there are statutory caps of $2,400 and $4,400 respectively. So how does that play out in terms of what people actually make?
Well, if they're trying to construct a practice that is entirely or mostly composed of court-appointed cases, they're in tough shape. The idea of a $4,400 cap on a felony case is scandalously low. There's a heavy incentive there for the lawyer then not to investigate the case closely, not to do thorough pretrial motion work, and not to try the case in the end, you know, to push a client toward resolving the case early and without a trial with a plea agreement.
Well, there may be some appeal to get over that. I'm a little bit iffy on that, but there may be a process.
And I don't know the specifics of New York law in this respect, but setting a cap like that is a formula for an uneven and therefore highly unreliable adversary system. Now, I'm not saying that every lawyer who takes a court-appointed case is going to be twisting his client's arm right away to plead guilty so that the lawyer doesn't lose his or her shirt. I'm not saying that. But what you're depending then is on the public-spiritedness of criminal defense lawyers and only criminal defense lawyers, in effect, to subsidize the public costs of prosecuting their own clients by at some point very early on with a $4,400 cap working for free. And even if there were no cap at $60 an hour, I can't speak to New York, but in my state, the average overhead for small law firms, if you broke it out by the hour, 40-hour week, 30-day month, is somewhere around $50 an hour. A little above, a little below. I don't remember now, but it's somewhere around $50 an hour. And I'm not talking about, Cravathsrain and Moore or the large silk stocking law firms. I'm talking about the average solo practice or one or two or, three lawyer practice, which is these are the small firms and solo practices that do the vast bulk of private criminal defense in this country. So if your overhead just to turn on the lights is running at, let's say, $50 an hour, what does $60 an hour leave for you? $10 an hour. And the reality is most people don't invest in their human capital with 3 years of law school and the, attending tuition or student loans after 4 years of undergraduate education to make $10 an hour. And we shouldn't ask them, honestly, to do that. Again, this is a way of skewing systematically the reliability of the criminal justice system against the poor, and the poor make up more than 80% of people charged with crimes in this country.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Dean Strang. He's a criminal defense attorney based in Madison, Wisconsin, and was one of Stephen Avery's attorneys in a case profiled in the Netflix series Making a Murderer. He's also the author of a book about an entirely different case titled Worse Than the Devil, Anarchists, Clarence Darrow, and Justice in a Time of Terror. So let's talk about that book. Give me a very brief overview of that case.
11 recent Italian immigrants clustered around a steel mill on Milwaukee's south side. And a proselytizing evangelical minister comes to the neighborhood on three successive weeks, isn't met with a good reception. World War I is on. The Italians in that neighborhood are not in favor of the war because Italy has essentially severed its long, long alliance with the Austro-Hungarian Empire and is fighting on the American side against the traditional allies of Italy. So strong anti-war sentiment among the Italian immigrants in that neighborhood, met with the patriotism of this evangelical minister. A melee breaks out. There's shooting. Two people die. two people from the neighborhood die. Mass arrests in the neighborhood, that gets sorted out to 11 people charged with conspiracy to kill the police, actually, because there were police officers involved in the melee. And while they're awaiting trial, in fact, just a few days before their trial on those charges were to begin, somebody places a bomb at the church of the evangelical minister. It's found. It's carried by a couple of teenage boys who are members of his congregation, carried to the central police station. And there, while the police were examining this apparent bomb, admiring the handiwork, essentially, of the bomb maker, it blows up. It's the greatest loss of police life in American history until September 11, 2001. Nine police officers died and one civilian in that bomb explosion that all but destroyed the Milwaukee Central Police Station. And in the atmosphere of pro-war fervor, anti-Italian and anti-radical sentiment, the 11 people are put on trial 2 days after the last of the police officers' funeral for the earlier crime, and the book picks up the story.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is the criminal defense attorney, Dean Strang. Okay, so you tell the story of that case, and I have to say, it's a story very well told. It's very well written. It turns out that Clarence Darrow, who's usually regarded through our eyes today as a defense attorney hero, may not have used the most high-minded tactics in this case. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, and indeed, those who study Darrow or are interested in him find very quickly that there are questions about Darrow's ethics and indeed his fidelity to the law that dog him through much of his career. But what's interesting about this case, for starters, is that Darrow is not the trial lawyer. That's how we remember Clarence Darrow, as a great trial lawyer. The Scopes Monkey trial, Leopold and Loeb, the Ossian Sweet case in Detroit. We remember him as a trial lawyer and not as an appellate lawyer, but he was not the trial lawyer in this Milwaukee case. He did take the appeal. So it was a relatively rare appellate undertaken by Darrow. And yes, I did uncover some evidence that Darrow may have conspired with the district attorney at the time to try to fix the appellate record to assure the release of the 11 Italians who were convicted. And I explore the evidence that supports, but in my mind doesn't conclusively establish that there was a dishonest effort made to fix the appellate record.
Now, what issues about the criminal justice and also the political system do you think this case raises, which might be relevant to us or even pressing on us today? I mean, the title, In a Time of Terror, and certainly that resonates today. So what parallels do you see?
Well, we were at war after early April 1917. Patriotism was high. We were at the back end of the largest wave of immigration the country's ever had for the two or three decades preceding 1917, and there was a good deal of anti-immigrant or nativist sentiment. Labor violence or violence in connection with the struggle between capital and labor was very common in the first couple decades of the 20th century. So dynamite bombs, violence on the picket line, the National Guard being called out and, massacring people, strikers or their families in some cases, as in Ludlow, Colorado in 1914. I mean, all of this sort of violence associated with this great struggle between labor and capital as the labor movement rose in the early 20th century was very common. Any of that sound familiar today, with patriotism, fear of terror associated with radical ideologies, and a nativist sentiment against newcomers, against people bringing strange customs. Italians were a despised group in the early 20th century in much of America. Catholics were a very suspect group for much of our history in the 18th and early 19th – or I'm sorry, the 19th and early 20th centuries. So I think there's some obvious parallels to – not just today but, you know, to the years immediately after World War II. For example, you know, the Vietnam era, we see sort of recurrent waves of fear and nativism and patriotism. And I guess my real academic interest is how do newcomers and outsiders fare in American courts during times of elevated fear of terror or elevated nativism and patriotism?
Now, do you have any new books in the works? I would imagine you're thinking about one on Stephen Avery, but I guess not. Tell me about the thing you're
working
on.
I'm not going to write about Stephen Avery. In fact, I don't think I'll ever write about a case in which I've been involved. My interest is more historical. I am working on another book during the same era, during the World War I era, exploring many of the same issues. But it's really the it's the IWW trial in federal court in Chicago in 1918, and then there were three other large groups of IWW members indicted elsewhere in the country. But the Chicago trial was the lead trial. It's the largest mass trial in U.S. civilian court history to this day by far. 166 people indicted, and that trial started with 112 people on trial in one courtroom with one jury at one time. So it's a fascinating story, and I think to a very large degree that IWW trial is when the federal Department of Justice becomes the U.S. Department of Justice we know. Hmm. When the federal government steps in to sort of create and implement a national and very legalistic strategy of attacking radical ideologies rather than the 19th century pattern and early 20th century pattern of local responses, often, you know, governors calling out the National Guard or local governments, sheriffs, mayors working closely with corporate interests to quell labor uprisings or violence associated with radical ideologies.
That was Dean Strang. Again, his book is titled Worse Than the Devil, Anarchists, Clarence Darrow, and Justice in a Time of Terror. You can find the first part of my conversation with Dean regarding the Stephen Avery case at wrvo.org. Dean, again, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks very much for having me both weeks.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.